The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Chelsea, Champions League dreamers. Tuchel unbeaten, they haven't conceded a goal in years. N'Golo Kante playing like it's 2017. And the German imports are getting better all the time. Could they win it? If not them, then who? We'll make some wildly safe predictions like I can't see past Bayern or City and then forget we ever made them. Also today, David Conn joins us to discuss the fallout from the Sheldon report. We'll round up the Football League with Ben Fisher, Norwich flying, Lee Bowyer going from the madness of Charlton to the madness of Birmingham. We'll answer your questions and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Alex writes, I feel like every time Barney, Barry and Wilson are on. They get a shout out for being the dream lineup. The rest of the cast of characters deserve more love. I'd take a trio of Jordan Jarrett Bryan, Anne-Marie Batson and Ben Fisher over Wednesday's pod in a 3-on-3 futsal any day of the week. Ben isn't here yet to hear that compliment and we won't repeat it to him. But Anne-Marie Batson is here. Hello, Anne-Marie.
Hello. Thank you so much for that. That's a lovely start to the pod.
It's a total, but it wasn't me. But, you know, it's an absolute pleasure. Jordan Jarrett Bryan and his hot takes are here.
Good morning, mate. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Thank you. Barry Glendenning.
Hello. Jordan and Anne-Marie, if you really want to endear yourself to the public, I think what you need to do is turn on the waterworks like Wilson did yesterday. That seemed
That's
to go
harsh.
Down well.
That's
and he's
harsh,
not here
Barry.
To defend himself yet either. Ooh.
If you cry on a pod, that's what the people want.
Nothing wrong with emotion.
Yeah, no. He was there. Wilson did a wonderful job. I very rarely give him praise, but yeah, it was delightful. And I'll read some of that praise out at the end of the pod. Let's start then with Chelsea beating Atleti 2-0 last night, 3-0 on aggregate. The first English club to eliminate Atletico Madrid from the knockout stage of a major European competition since Gary Megson's Bolton Wanderers in the 2007-08 UEFA Cup last 32. Anne-Marie, they were brilliant last night. Just sort of, they made it look so easy.
Yeah, they did. I mean, for the first 15 minutes or so, I was feeling a little bit bored watching the match, and then it started to get into it. Chelsea were playing with a lot of confidence. Mendy didn't have a lot to do yesterday. I was really pleased with Ziyech getting that goal, and also Werner and Havertz playing a part of that. The three of them actually clicking in place. And of course, Zuma played yesterday. Christensen didn't make the team because he wasn't very well. He did really good. And then Conte as well. Did he not stop running the entire match? Really good performance from Chelsea. It bodes well for them for the next stages.
Owen says, have we all forgotten how good Kante is when he's at his best? Pete Kante or the Kante twins? Surely one of the first players you'd want in a World 11, Jordan. It was like Leicester Kante or first year Chelsea Kante, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And I think that the standards that he set himself in that Leicester season and the subsequent following year at Chelsea was so high, and then winning the World Cup was so high, there was going to be a dip. There was going to be a drop at some point. And I mean, even the drop, I don't think, was as bad as people made it out to be, personally. But yeah, definitely we saw yesterday, as you say, Pete Kante. I think wider with Chelsea as well, they look so good, but not. I was thinking about it last night, and they're like the guy that a lot of my female friends describe as the guy that, on paper, it's got all the qualities, trustworthy, gets the job done, but a bit boring.
What job exactly?
Couldn't put it better myself, Jordan.
On paper, you think, yeah, this is the dream guy, but nah, I just feel like, I'm with Anne-Marie.
I think that's slightly unfair. I think, I don't know if I can persist with your analogy, Jordan, but I was sitting there thinking,
give it a try.
They are really tight and they are defensively really good, but they also play lovely football, and it doesn't feel like parking a bus. Or if they are parking a bus, it's a really nice bus. It's not like the Tottenham bus, you know. It's a bus that can go 0 to 60 in 3 seconds.
That's a good bus. That's an impressive bus, to be fair. Yeah, but I think, as Anne-Marie says, I think in parts, whilst I think I trust them that they're not going to concede, there are long parts of the game where I'm just a bit like, This is just a bit drab. Now, look, Tuchel's still relatively new to the job there. I think he's obviously still bedding in, and I think he's building the foundations for a team that next year can really compete on both the front of the Premier League and Champions League. But yeah, I think there's a lot of periods where they're just a little bit dull. The clean sheet record is absolutely insane. They deserve credit for that. And I think that what he's doing is clearly working on defence first. And hopefully next year will be that exciting, more funny, charismatic, ideal boyfriend next season, where we can score lots more goals. But they look good, but at times I do find myself, you know, drifting off looking at my phone when Chelsea play.
Maybe that's just your attention span. I don't know. It's like nine.
It probably is.
It's 9.5 hours since they conceded a goal, and I thought, Barry, I thought Kai Havertz, you can see he's such a wonderful footballer, and Timo Werner, who I'm going to keep saying is going to score buckets every time he hammers one into the near post side netting again. But they were both sort of key yesterday. I thought they both played really well.
Yeah, I'm kind of still dwelling on the fact that all Jordan's female friends are happy with a bloke who just gets the job done.
You know? I wouldn't be, Barry, for sure.
It seems a very low bar. But
Indeed.
Perhaps he could introduce me to some of them. I think I tick that box. Oh. No frills.
I don't think anybody wants to think about this.
And yet I'm still single.
But anyway, yes, to the question you asked me. Timo Werner played splendidly last night. He was really, really good. I would love for him to score. I think he will score lots of goals. He clearly is desperate to score, hence the relentless shooting from very narrow angles into the side netting, as you alluded to. But his support play is brilliant. A lot of people thought Olivier Giroud would start last night, and the sentimentalists among us probably hoped he would start, but he didn't. And Thomas Tuchel explained that the reason he didn't start was because Timo Werner is a much faster runner than he is, and so it came to pass. Chelsea scored with this, you know, lightning fast counter-attack, which Timo Werner played a pivotal role. His pass was perfectly weighted, just the right height for Ziyech to score, and they were hugely impressive. They finally clicked, I suppose.
I'm fascinated by Kai Havertz as well, because obviously the fee he came for was a huge fee. Lots of fanfare from the kind of hipsters and fashionistas of football that this is the generational talent, of which I was one of the people saying that as well. And I think next year, I don't think Chelsea will go out and spend a lot of money on a centre forward. I suspect they may try and, as is the new trend, use Kai Havertz as a false nine. I can see him scoring that kind of 12 to 16 goals next season. But I think with Kai Havertz next year, one of two things will happen, one of two extremes. I think either he's going to be in contention for player of the year in firing Chelsea to a top two finish, or the opposite. He'll go down as one of the people that has discussed one of the worst Premier League signings of all time. He'll be the interesting player to watch next year, because I think how well Chelsea do next year, I think Tuchel will make him the focal point of that. And I can see him being the guy that gets just as many games as Tammy Abrahams and Timo Werner through the middle, because that seems to be how he wants to play that Chelsea team next year.
I bet you a pound, Jordan, that he's somewhere in between the best player in the league.
Sold. One thing I'm confident on is that we won't be talking this time next year of having an okay season. Okay. He'll have a bomb and we'll be like 70 million, or he'll be player of the year, one of the two.
I love the fact that the thing I'll be looking for next season for the whole of 2021-22 is for Kai Havertz to be a 7 out of 10. That's that's what I'm looking forward to. Harry asked the question, is it possible to send a player off for violent conduct and also book a player for simulation at the same time, Anne-Marie? I mean, Rudiger's done this before, didn't he? When Heung-Min Son was sent off, like Rudiger went down. I mean, obviously, lots of players do it. It's not just Antonio Rudiger. But I would like the ref to go, you did elbow him, Mr. Savage, and you're silly because I told you not to do it like a second before you did it. But also, Mr. Rudiger, you didn't need to fall on the floor, so I'm booking you there.
About time. I think it's about time the referees really do clamp on this, because it's just getting ridiculous now. I mean, Rudiger is a really tall, weighty bloke. The way he went down yesterday, I mean, It was just embarrassing to watch, actually. And yeah, it was right that Savic got the red card, of course, because it was violent conduct. But Rudiger did make a meal of it. And we're seeing this more and more within the game. And I wish the refs would really clamp down on it, because I think it needs to send a message. I mean, he didn't need to go down in that particular way. He rolled around as if he was in so much pain and then got back on his feet and was back on it again. It's ridiculous.
You're saying, think of the children.
I disagree. I think while it's embarrassing to see players go down after being blown on, I think if you're stupid enough a player to elbow someone or pinch someone and get caught for it, then the person's within their rights to go down.
Yeah.
I personally wouldn't do it, but I just think if you're going to elbow someone or nudge someone, then...
Yeah, but yeah, I don't mind that, Jordan, but the fact that he was, you know, he rolled around as if he was in so much pain. Look, I've been knocked in the chest and I've got two things in front of me which make the pain even worse, but I don't drop down and roll around the ground as if I've been shot. It was embarrassing.
I suppose the point is, and this goes back to that, I can't remember who it was in goal when Phil Foden went past and didn't go down and didn't get a penalty when it was so obviously a penalty. Was it Alex McCarthy?
It was Southampton, I think.
Yeah, and the point is, if Rudiger just didn't go down there, the ref probably wouldn't send Savic off. And that's the problem. There's just, I mean, in a way, I'd prefer it if it was like at school when if Rudiger had not gone down, but had gone up to the ref and go, you know, miss. Did you see what he did? Either way, it is annoying, but I guess it's...
But on the sending off, I mean, there was a kind of delicious irony in that it happened to a Diego Simeone team and, you know, he famously did much the same against... in a match against England and got David Beckham sent off, you know, correctly, but it was very devious on his part and there were histrionics. What I loved about this red card was that Stefan Savic had to walk after being sent off and after complaining at great length, had to walk the length of the pitch, go under the stand, then walk across the car park to, I'm pretty sure, Atleti... We're getting changed in the Chelsea Health Club and Spa at Stamford Bridge instead of the away dressing room because of COVID restrictions. So I checked on Google Maps. So he had a 5-minute walk back to the dressing room to think about what he'd done.
And the spa won't be open either. So that he couldn't even have a hot stone massage or a mineral bath.
But, I mean, it's such a long walk of shame.
Yeah. Atleti were flat, Jordan, weren't they? But they had two penalty shouts here. And no one really mentioned the first one where Rudiger just pushes Suarez over. It's a soft foul, but it's still a foul. I don't understand why that. No one's saying that's not a penalty. But he gets his arm and pushes him, right? The second one, Carrasco, Aspilicueta's got his hand on him. Sid tweeted yesterday, in Spain, that's a penalty. He's not saying it should be a penalty. He just is saying, as a matter of fact, in Spain, that would be given as a penalty. Do they have reason to be frustrated about those? Or should they have just played better?
They were poor, first of all, so the better team definitely went through. But the second one is a penalty for sure. That's a clear penalty for me. I don't understand why that wasn't given.
And a red card then?
And a red card, yeah, definitely. The first one, I'm not so sure. It's definitely a penalty.
Oh, it was. I think the first one was worse.
Do you think?
Yeah, definitely. It was a blatant shove and totally brainless and needless.
I thought it was... what I took from that incident was Suarez is done. It was Rudiger muscling Suarez out of the way. You're done, mate. Your time in Europe as a leading footballer is over. That's what I took from that incident. I didn't think it was an... If it was given, I wouldn't be an uproar about it. But it, for me, didn't scream, that's an obvious penalty to me. So that one, I'm not so sure.
Imagine if Suarez had pushed Rudiger with that force. I mean, he'd have flown out the stadium, wouldn't he?
He'd have landed on the roof of the health club and spa.
The spa, yeah. 5 minutes away.
So look, well done, Chelsea. They're looking really good. They are into the last eight. Bayern Munich also, they beat Lazio 2-1, 6-2 on aggregate. Lewandowski, he scored again from the penalty spot. Eric Maxim, Choupo-Moting, got the second. And maybe we mock Choupo-Moting too much just because he was at one point at Stoke. But he scored a lovely finish there. There was one pass from Leroy Sané to Serge Gnabry towards the end of this game that was just such a delight. It just fooled everybody. I mean, it's a pretty tasty last eight, as you'd probably expect. Bayern, Manchester City, Liverpool, Chelsea, Dortmund, Porto, Real Madrid and PSG. Can we make some wild predictions? I mean, of all the wild predictors on the panel today. I might start with Jordan. That's acceptable. Where are you going to? What from left field are you going to suggest here?
Nothing crazily left field, Max. But and I feel dirty for saying this. Really dirty for saying this. I'm going with PSG. I've got a feeling this is PSG's year. We know about their firepower, but I think that they're not ripping it up in France, granted, but I've just got a gut feeling. I can't give any more intelligent analysis on why beyond that. I just think this is their year. I think they were unlucky to meet by far the best team in Europe last year in the final. I think City may do a City and overthink it, despite their improvements defensively. Bayern, I think on paper, are the clear favourites, but I've just got a feeling that this might be PSG's year.
Surely it's not unlucky to meet the best team in the final. It's just unlucky to meet them in.
I suppose so. Yes. Yeah. That is
lucky.
True,
it's lucky to meet them in the final.
I suppose so. Yeah. Yeah. If you could pick, you want to be the best team at the last possible point of the competition for sure. Yeah. No, I'm going with PSG.
Anne-Marie, what do you reckon?
I'm going with Bayern Munich again. They've barely put a foot wrong so far. They're clinical. They're ruthless. They're sending a message to the rest of the teams in the competition. I went for them last year. I'm going to go for them again this year. And I think Man City are actually behind Bayern Munich this time. I think they would have learned the lessons, as Jordan mentioned that word, overthinking. And I think they would have, you know, taken that on board this time. So I'm going to go for them. And then I'd put PSG after that, despite their slightly...
I think you're only allowed one, Andrew.
Oh, I'm in my order.
It's not a horse race. Kind of each PSG each way.
It's Tottenham this week. So my three, Bayern Munich and then Man City and then PSG.
Do you know what, Baz? I'd love Bayern Munich City to be a quarterfinal. A, because I'd like to see two legs of it. And B, I'd quite like someone random to go further.
I would rather see them play over one leg, to be honest. You know, I find the group stages extremely tedious, but I love the knockout stages. I absolutely love them. And I'm really looking forward to these. I don't care who wins particularly. I really want PSG to not win. But beyond that, I'm not fussed.
All right. The draw is on Friday. We'll react to it on Monday, if we remember. And that'll do for part one. David Conn joins us after the break to talk about a thoroughly depressing story, the Sheldon Inquiry into Sex Abuse in Football. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, the FA has apologised after a review found that inexcusable institutional failures meant children were not kept safe from sex abusers. The independent review into child sex abuse in football between 1970 and 2005 also found failings at 8 professional clubs: Chelsea, Aston Villa, Newcastle, Manchester City, Crewe Alexandra, Stoke City, Peterborough United and Southampton. Within the report, there is heartbreaking testimony from survivors who speak of the long-term damage the abuse has caused. David Conn has covered the story for The Guardian and joining us now. David, first of all, can you just explain why this inquiry was set up?
Yeah, the inquiry was set up after Andy Woodward, the former Crewe player, did his first interview with The Guardian in 2016, speaking out about the abuse that he'd suffered at the hands of Barry Bunnell when he was at Crewe, which just prompted this overwhelming coming forward of people who'd been abused at Crewe and at other clubs in the 1980s, and mainly in the 1980s and before and after as well. And the FA set up this inquiry, led by the barrister Clive Sheldon QC, to look at essentially how was this allowed to happen, how did it happen, which included, as you said, some of the particular clubs where some of the most notorious and prolific abusers were, like Bunnell at City, Crewe and Stoke, and to look at what was known at those clubs and whether anything could have been done in particular at those clubs. So he's looked at it in general and in particular at the individual clubs where some of the worst abusers were.
And what are the main findings?
Well, this point about that the FA was guilty of institutional failure and failed to keep children safe, I thought it was really important in my coverage to be really clear that Sheldon is saying that about after 1995. And that was after Barry Bunnell was first convicted. And it was essentially after all abuse had taken place. So he is not actually saying that the FA was guilty of institutional failure and failed to keep children safe, leading to that abuse in the 70s, 80s and up to the mid-90s. That was about not being quick enough to introduce safeguarding after 1995. Before that, in other words, during this awful period where so many young footballers were abused by these predatory paedophiles and abusers, he's saying, which I thought was very important, there was just no child protection, there was no safeguarding. There were no policies. They didn't even have criminal record checks in those days. I presume not just in football, across all sports, probably in many areas of life. And as we know, there are many, many areas of life where children were not with their parents, where there was terrible abuse because they were open to it and they were not protected.
What have survivors said about this report?
From what I've seen, their main issue was that Sheldon makes some recommendations for improvement to the current safeguarding and child protection systems and structures, which are a world away from what they were in in the 1980s. And everybody recognises that there is child protection, obviously different levels of child protection at different levels of the game. But I mean, you know, something like a criminal record check, we're all utterly familiar that if we've done any volunteering, even at a school, you know, they do that now. But Sheldon's making some recommendations, such as having a champion of children's safety at board level at the FA and having an annual report on safeguarding. And some of the survivors were dismissive of this and said they just didn't see why that had taken a four-year report by a QC to come up with pretty common sense measures for improvement. And there have been calls for outside regulation of safeguarding. But the FA, while apologising unreservedly for the abuse that young people suffered, was saying and was trying to communicate just how improved safeguarding child protection is now. And I have been told by independent experts on this that actually it's regarded as a very high standard now of child protection.
The chief executive of the FA, Mark Bullingham, said, "Today is a dark day for the beautiful game, one on which we must acknowledge the mistakes of the past and ensure we do everything possible to prevent them being repeated." Because it's institutional, David, will there be repercussions for individuals or not? Or is this not what this is about?
I think that they did have a look at individuals. At the FA, in terms of all that period from 1970 to 1995, where he's saying there was no child protection, Sheldon actually says that he doesn't find the FA blameworthy. And he seems to say that that was the culture in Britain at the time, that child protection and safeguarding weren't adequately recognised and they weren't considered to be, that abuse wasn't something that had to be particularly guarded against in sports, not just in football. And so while he's gone into individual clubs and looked at what did they know, what could they have done, he doesn't really seem to have done the same with the FA during that period. And I don't think that we're expecting any individuals who are at the FA during that period, there to be any action against them. The FA confirmed yesterday that Dario Grady was obviously the manager of Crewe at the time when Barry Bunnell was abusing the young players, and who was actually, I think, the assistant manager at Chelsea when the prolific abuser Eddie Heath was abusing young players there. And there was an incident in 1975 where Dario Grady said that he should have done more because he did actually receive a specific complaint at Chelsea. But otherwise, there have been prosecutions of the actual abusers, but I don't think that it looks like there's going to be any action being taken against people at clubs. And I think one element of the findings about what did people know that it's really important to understand is that the feeling that people must have known, because it was so horrific, that people must have known what was going on. Sheldon says, actually, they didn't. Even at Crewe, there were no specific reports made to the club or to Dario Grady of actual abuse. Same at Manchester City, where Bunnell was there for a long time And in effect, same at every club. There's a complaint very late in the day at Newcastle, and then they were slow and they kept George Ormond on after that. So there's criticism there. But overall, what he's then saying is that there's no specific reports. One of the terrible effects of this kind of abuse is that the victims, who are obviously young, are bullied, terrified, feelings of shame, and they stay silent and in the vast majority of cases don't tell anybody at all. And so Sheldon's left saying, but were there rumours, were there concerns, were there things that could have been acted on?
David, the report was commissioned in 2016. Why has it taken so long to get to this point?
Sheldon did say that he was sorry that it had taken so long, and that's something that some of the survivors have said, that, you know, that it's taken a very long time and they've been waiting and waiting and waiting for it. He did have a big team of other barristers working on it with him, and it is a very substantial piece of work. And I think one of the explanations is that they had to wait until all the prosecutions were finished because they wanted to review what had come out in court, and there might have been follow-up inquiries for them to make after the prosecutions. So I think that's the explanation they've given for it taking so long.
One thing you touched on there were the rumours that could have been acted upon. There were rumours about Crewe. They were nicknamed the pedos. Now, you can't possibly say that that wouldn't have got somebody's antennae twitching.
Yeah, and this is what he finds. So Sheldon's findings are that there were no specific reports of abuse that were made to Dario Gradi or the chairman of Crewe or the directors, but there were rumours. And like you say, taunts of the Crewe players for a period of time. And at City as well, when Bunnell was there. And he is critical of them. And he's saying that he's not judging by modern standards of safeguarding when there would be so many red flags. And boys just wouldn't be allowed to stay at coaches' houses, which they were doing at Crewe, at Dario Grady's house and at Bunnell's house. But he says, looking at the standards of the time, the common sense and experience that they should have applied, he does find that they were failings at Crewe and that they should have done more to at least look at what was happening at Bunnell's house and inquire into the welfare of the boys. And as people are saying, and as Sheldon himself says, if that had been done, and it isn't just at Crewe, it's also at City, it's also at Chelsea, if that had been done, then they just might have uncovered what was happening. And perhaps some of it could have been stopped.
And of those eight clubs who are mentioned specifically by Sheldon, have what they've said in the last 12, 16 hours been consistent? Have they all come out and all apologised in the same way?
From what I've seen so far, Manchester City have made apologies and they've said that they've been making personal apologies, that a senior board member has been meeting some of the survivors and making personal apologies. Newcastle expressed apologies, Southampton did, Peterborough did. I don't think that we've seen any statement at all from Crewe, which obviously is the club that most people, you know, there's a huge amount of focus on, because Bunnell was... It was horrendous, and Bunnell was there for so long, and Andy Woodward, Steve Walters, Gary Cliff, Ian Ackley, these people have come out and talked about it. And Crewe throughout have been very, very slow to speak, and what they've said has not satisfied the survivors and not satisfied people. And again here, I don't think we've seen anything yet.
We should say that in response to the report, Chelsea and Aston Villa have also both publicly apologised, and Stoke City, whilst not apologising, did say that they welcomed the report. We should also add that with regards to former Crewe manager Dario Gradi, the report found no evidence that he'd acted inappropriately with any of the boys who stayed at his house or any of the boys that he was working with, but the FA did announce this morning that Gradi is, quote, effectively banned for life. Thanks to David Conn there. We are planning to do a special podcast on this subject soon. We'll be back in just a second.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's talk about the Football League. Ben Fisher is the Guardian's Football League correspondent and great with anecdotes, of course he is. Welcome, Ben.
Hi, Max. How you doing?
Yeah, really good. You got anything for us today?
Don't know if I have, to be honest.
Oh,
I know.
No. Yeah, absolutely right, Jordan.
Fisher out.
Something will turn up, Jordan. You know
the
it
The problem
will.
Is when you set the bar as high as Ben did with his opening anecdote about the car park at Swansea, was it? It's really hard to follow that up.
Absolutely right. Anyway.
I mean, you know, Max, you only have, three anecdotes?
It's true. And I've made a career out of it. So, you know, Ben needs one more because remember he's got... Where did you go on holiday with your mum? Because it's got the same name.
Nancy.
You went to Nancy because your mum's called Nancy. That's it. Very short number of holiday locations for Ben Fisher. Right. Norwich are 10 points clear of the Championship. 2-0 at Forest last night. Playing lovely stuff. Their second goal, Ben, was great. And they could have had about 10 by half time, couldn't they?
Yeah, I think that's 9 wins in a row now. And I suppose it feels a bit like Manchester City in the Premier League. It's kind of the inevitable, it feels like now, with them. And I think they have actually... I think Daniel Farke has actually done a lot better job than he'll maybe get credit for. Obviously, they're not there yet, but it looks that way, doesn't it? And yeah, I think Farke has actually done a really good job there to manage the situation because, you know, they came down pretty emphatically and they look really good. And they're the one team that have looked consistently sort of head and shoulders above others in that league. I think you could make a case for really only them for sort of blowing teams away. Others have kind of had their day, but they've had other wobbles as well.
Do you see anything in them that means they'll be different in the Premier League next season?
I'm not sure, Max. I mean, I think the problem they've got is just that gulf is so big, isn't it? We've seen it, you know, this season in the Premier League. I mean, Sheffield United were the anomaly, and then look at them when they sort of try to throw a bit of money at it and sort of go one better. I think Norwich, you know, they're going to have to recruit well again, and it'll be interesting what happens to some of their coveted players, Max Ahrens, Emi Buendia, Todd Cantwell. They all have sort of a long list of admirers, but, you know, they're obviously going to, you know, would like to keep them, but whether they can is... It's another thing, isn't it? Because I don't know if those players are going to want a relegation scrap on their return to the Premier League.
If you're a team that has the ball all the time one season and then you don't have the ball at all the next season, it's like it's completely different.
Max Ahrens, for example, in the Championship is allowed to sort of maraud forward. He bombs forward with sort of great gusto from full back, and you know that's great. And in the Premier League, you just he won't and didn't get that same chance really to do that. Obviously, there was moments, but yeah, it's a very different thing. And I think also mentally, it's an interesting shift, isn't it, from a team that is kind of used to losing every week to then winning every week. And then kind of, if and when they get promoted, it's sort of almost back to reality, you know, here we go again.
It's almost like they shouldn't bother trying. Like there's no point to any of it. The Norwich purgatory of just going up and down every year.
The new West Brom.
Exactly. That's the dream, isn't it? What about Watford's second beat Rotherham 4-1? Again, I mean, I think they could have scored 100 in the first half of this game. 8 wins in 9. I did notice Ben Foster is not in goal, Ben, and I'm not happy about that. What's going on?
Yeah, Daniel Backman, well, he was out injured, and I think it's just a case of Daniel Backman's done well in his absence. I think they'll ease Foster back in, I would have thought. You know, brilliant goalkeeper, great character as well. Leader in that dressing room. And yeah, kudos to Watford because, you know, it's a bit of a messy club at times, but there they are, kind of in the box seat in second at the moment. And we could have a realistic scenario where the three teams that come up were the three that came down, which would be incredibly dull. But obviously, Bournemouth are the ones that maybe are going to have to fight really hard to make it happen from here on in.
Who's the Watford manager?
Just Isco Munoz.
Right, okay. So Kiko Sanchez-Flores, he does every other one, doesn't he? So he'll come in he'll be 5 weeks into next season in the Premier League. What about below them? It's sort of stretching out a bit, isn't it? I remember the Championship was incredibly tight about sort of a month or two ago, and it seems to be stretching a little bit in the playoff run.
Yeah, there was that chasing pack of sort of 5-6 teams, and now you could make a case to say that it's maybe 2 or 3 teams, because Barnsley have gone on a great run, and you know I wanted to big up Barnsley really. And last night on Wednesday they made it 9 wins from 10, unbeaten in 12, and basically they've made it an awful lot more difficult for everybody else with any kind of faint hopes of getting in there. Cardiff are still just about hanging on. Obviously, Bournemouth are outside that top six at the moment. And Reading maybe are the team that might kind of give cause for optimism to those below them. But sort of Stoke, Preston, maybe Middlesbrough as well, to be fair. But Stoke, Preston, Blackburn, Bristol City have all kind of fallen away in recent weeks. Some quite sort of spectacularly.
Don't Barnsley, a Barnsley sort of money ball orientated club?
Yeah, that's kind of the roots of their model, really, Max. I mean, Billy Beane is a minority investor there. Obviously, him and Data have a nice handy, you know, a great relationship, if you like. And
don't mock Billy, Ben. He listens to Football Weekly. And a valued listener he is.
Hi, Billy Beane.
Like every other
listener. Of course,
listener.
Hi all the other listeners.
No, it's a great model, and it's just amazing because it's almost a budget version of Brentford, if you like, and it's a really interesting project what they're doing there. I mean, if you come back to Nancy, which I'm sure we would like to.
Yeah, of course.
You know, yeah, they are one of the sister clubs of Barnsley that you know own. It's a bit like the Red Bull project. I spoke to their CEO last week, and they're very much inspired by Red Bull, which obviously is quite an interesting project. A bit like Man City and the CFG group. There, albeit you know, this is kind of a different ball game in terms of the figures. But yeah, the record signing remains 1.5 million, which is absolutely staggering in an era where you know clubs' wages and wage bills and you know, every season some clubs are breaking their transfer records. So for Barnsley to be doing this on a relative pittance is extraordinary.
For football fans of a certain vintage, to be described as a budget Brentford really does set the bar as staggeringly low. I know Brentford are different now, but in my mind, it's like I'm walking into a boardroom going, we're going to be the budget Brentford, everybody. You'd be like, I mean, I don't know. It doesn't fill me with hopes and dreams, but...
It might have been a tough sell once, but now, you know, they really are the model club, Max.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
Speaking of model clubs, Ben, Birmingham City.
Yeah.
Yeah, why would Lee Bowyer, why would you leave Charlton, which is batshit crazy, and go, of all the places to go, you just think, do you know what, I'd like a slightly easier life, I'll go to Birmingham.
Yeah, it is bonkers, isn't it, from the outside looking at it. I do know that, I mean, this is sort of stating the obvious, but Lee Bowyer is really confident, adamant he can be the man to turn it around. I know he had a great connection with the club when he was a player there. Obviously, in fairness to him, got a great result on Wednesday last night against Reading. You know, a victory in his first game. And yeah, he's confident he can do it. I think the problem there is there's so much mess off the field. The chief executive is, I don't think, the easiest person necessarily to work with. It's been a sort of staff exodus in the last couple of years owing to that partly. And a very messy club. But Bowyer, I think, is a really impressive guy. Whether he can be the man to do it is another thing.
Ben, did the mess begin after Gary Rowett left in 2016?
Yeah, I mean, basically, the owners wanted, you know, a sexy football, sexy appointment.
Hey, hang on, Gary Rowett. He is, I mean, I remember him as a spotty ginger teenage winger, right? And then he became a centre-back. But he has aged incredibly well. I'm talking in terms
of philosophy here, Max.
Fine, carry on.
But I mean, yeah, and Zola, I mean, I think Rowett is a great manager, but Zola obviously wasn't that man, and that was a pretty disastrous appointment. And from there, they've just spiralled. I mean, they've been firefighting ever since. You know, Redknapp went in there, spent loads of money. You know, claimed he wasn't really aware that they were spending loads of money. Steve Cottrell, Pep Clotet, you know, everyone sort of tried. I mean, and Karanka, they really thought he was going to be the, not just, you know, make them better and sort of push towards mid-table. They thought he could lead them back to the, you know, the top table. And, you know, it's just been disastrous. And the players, I don't think, were overly enamoured with him kind of throwing them under the bus publicly after games and things like that, saying, you know, he sort of ran out of ideas. So... yeah, be interesting what Bowyer, what sort of tune he can get out of them for the rest of the season.
I think Harley Dean, who scored the winner yesterday, celebrated by shrugging. And apparently the Birmingham fans had started counting the number of shrugs Aitor Karanka had done in post-match interviews. And in some of them, he'd gone up to like 30 shrugs. And I think that's why Harley Dean did the shrugging celebration. Perhaps to say, I'll miss you, Gaffer. Perhaps not. That is not for us to say.
I seem to vaguely recall at one stage, I think it was when Harry Redknapp was in charge, Birmingham had like about 45 senior players. Is that correct? And is that still the case?
Oh, I don't know about those exact numbers, Barry, but yeah, they did have a really bloated squad. And, you know, it was kind of a case of, I mean, talking to people this week, the recruitment, I think, for a long time has been very scattergun, very easily. I think people there have been easily swayed sort of high up that club. And therefore, you end up with this mishmash of players. And obviously, every time a new manager comes in, you end up with players they don't want, which, interestingly, is why Barnsley, Brentford and those clubs are so adamant that their model is the one to work. So you don't end up with that player wastage, which, I mean, Birmingham are the prime example of that because the turnover has just been crazy.
I have this vision of, you know, walking through St. Andrews, you open a random cupboard and Nico Crankier sitting in there.
Adel Tarapt is just in a corner somewhere. Crouchy's still on a contract somehow. All right, down into League One and League Two. And before we talk at length about Cambridge United, Ben, League One, give us a potted set of excitement. I've seen some Ipswich fans who are still disappointed about life.
Yeah, I mean, I'll start with another sort of one of the big fish in that division, if you like, in Sunderland. I think you have to give huge kudos to Lee Johnson for the job he's done there in a relatively short space of time. I know maybe the Papa John's trophy is not high up anyone's list, probably not one on the bucket list, shall we say, but silverware, trophy, and they're now in a really good place in the league, up to third after beating Accrington, and if they win games in hand, could, in theory, go top. So, you know, a great turnaround, really, because, you know, they were going nowhere fast, really, with Phil Parkinson, and Lee Johnson really seems to have them pushing in the right direction with real intent. And I think they'll be tricky to stop now.
Their owner is a 23-year-old billionaire. I just don't know if 23-year-olds should be billionaires. I just can't even, and I'm the squarest person on earth, but even I would be irresponsible with billions of pounds when I was 23.
What were you doing at 23, Max?
I think I was probably reporting on Peterborough's oldest lamppost on BBC Radio Cambridgeshire, and the updates on whether the guided bus would be built on the A14. I mean, this should interest you, Ben.
I was just going to say, more importantly, what were you doing, Ben, at 23? I want a story.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think
Ben probably isn't much older than 23, are you?
I'm 26. I mean, I was just bumbling around the Guardian office, I think, coming in probably sweating late after rushing down the, you know, off the platform.
I mean,
so, yeah.
I wouldn't open with that one, but, you know, there you go. We know where the bar is. Talk to me about Ipswich, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Paul Cook's gone in there with Gary Roberts, and the expectation is that they're going to push, but it's just a bit half-hearted, I think, at the moment, in terms of what you're getting. The output is probably not what Ipswich fans would like it to be. I mean, it's easy to say with hindsight, but I think I said this a couple of weeks ago. I wasn't sure the timing was right, because as much as Paul Lambert and Marcus Evans, obviously the owner, were getting a lot of grief, Paul Lambert was picking up a couple of results. So, you know, it was quite a bold move, quite a brave move at the time. And, I mean, we'll see, won't it? The proof will be in the pudding, because they have to get in the playoffs, really.
What about League Two? A great week for Cambridge, who didn't play, but no one at the top could win. And it is so tight up there. We talked about the Championship sort of just slightly spreading out a bit. The top of League Two is ludicrous.
Yeah, it's crazy. And you've got a nice clutch of clubs, all with something to fight for, which is nice, isn't it? It makes it interesting. Forest Green could be a really good story if they can get over the line. Obviously, a really interesting club in terms of what they do. Very innovative. There's always something new going on there. I know Hector Bellerin is a shareholder there now. So, lots to be excited about. I think, you know, Tranmere felt very hard done by last season, probably rightly so, in terms of how they came up in or ended up in League Two, obviously on the PPG. And then you've got Bolton, you know, obviously one of the big clubs in that division with a really good chance after a really slow start. So, yeah, plenty of clubs with sort of promotion ambitions still in the mix. And another one being Salford, of course, with, you know, plenty of backing.
Yeah, Salford looked good when they hammered us, and Bolton, who beat us the other week, were absolutely brilliant. I think the best team I've seen in the division. It was interesting. I tweeted Bolton are good, and lots of Bolton fans got sort of were like, "Oh, you really understand the club." And it's like, no, they just played well. It's like, you know, if you say Bolton are bad, if you say a club are bad, and I could have said that about Oldham because we beat them. They were 2-0 up and we scored four. Oldham fans, surely they just go, yeah, actually, we are bad. Anyway.
Just at the other end, I was going to say, Max, I mean, you almost have Southend and Grimsby who are kind of fighting it out in the battle of the crisis clubs. They are quite grim stories. Neither look very well placed to stay up, you know, to put it simply. So there'll be no doubt a sort of post-mortem, an inquest there, because both those clubs look pretty mismanaged and they've kind of dropped like a stone, really, in Southend's case. Yeah, and obviously Barrow, they haven't had the season they wanted in their first taste of the Football League, but they have won three in a row, so that's given them a fighting chance.
Gwigsy said, can we expect the next instalment in the Parking Chronicles from Ben? Well, we've already established that we're not going to get it. You're just keeping people wanting more, which is a key part of it, Ben. You might as well hang around for the rest of the pod. We've only got a couple of minutes left. The FA Cup quarterfinals, everybody. Are you going to Bournemouth, Southampton, Ben? That's sort of your patch, isn't it?
I am, yeah. Somebody labelled that my derby, so...
Really? Who was that? Who called that the Ben Fisher derby? Maybe Harry Redknapp might have a claim at it.
It's a big game, really, because both teams... I mean, Southampton are in a funny place at the moment where they're on this dreadful run. And obviously they beat Sheffield United, which was huge, really, looking back at it now. And I think they will be fine in the league, but it's going to be quite a struggle, I think, for them in the remaining game. So the cup, obviously, is that, as they say, the distraction. And for Bournemouth, too, it gives them a chance of reaching their first semi-final so in the FA Cup. So, yeah, a nice game.
Yeah, Southampton have taken the Cup seriously, haven't they? I mean, they played Arsenal and they put out a full-strength team and Arsenal didn't. Interesting to see what side they put out. Can anybody see past Manchester City? Everton got City. Jordan, what do you reckon? Could Everton be the
No.
No more to say, is there, Jordan? No.
Not really. City are my team to win that one.
Chelsea, Sheffield United. Presumably, we expect Chelsea to win that. And I guess Leicester, Manchester United, Anne-Marie, is the sort of hardest to predict of these games.
Yeah, I mean, Leicester have had a fairly consistent run up until the last few games or so, where I think injuries are starting to play their part. And then Manchester United just keeping their eye on the top four at the moment. I think that's my pick of the draw, Max, that one between Leicester City and Manchester United. Of course, Leicester will want to try and get a cup, and the same for Manchester United as well. I'm not going to call it, though. I think he could go either way.
Barry?
I think Leicester will win this, and I hope they do. I've been very impressed with Brendan Rodgers this season. I always thought he was a bit of a buffoon who was far too pleased with himself. Not unlike myself, but he has had awful luck with injuries this season and has never once complained and has always made a point of saying, you know, he's probably effing and jeffing behind the scenes, but in public he has never complained and said, look, it happens, there's nothing we can do about it. Each injury we get is a new challenge, a new puzzle to figure out, and he's been figuring it out very well. So I would like to see Leicester to advance.
I agree. I want Leicester to kind of go far in this as well. But I think to Anne-Marie's point, I think United need to win this cup. They need a trophy quite badly. I think top four for them now is wrapped. I think the West Ham win on a week or so, what was it, last week? That for me cemented their top four spot. So that's done. They need a trophy. I know they're in Europe still as well, but I think they need to really go for this cup big time.
Interestingly, Solskjaer said, it felt like a bit of a weird swipe at Mourinho saying, you know, cups are for egotists. Or, you know, it's good for your ego, but the league is what really matters, I guess, because they're doing okay in the league. And the Milan game is going to be hard, obviously, for the few people that listen to this pod before that game is played. If anything really exciting happens in the Europa League, we'll look back at it on Monday. Ben says, Antarctica has a penguin population of 21 million. The population of Ireland is 6.6 million. Should those penguins invade Ireland, each person would have to fight around 3.18 penguins. Does Barry feel his country would defeat such a feathered horde?
I think we would, yeah. Given that a sizable portion of the Irish population would be either too old or too young to go into hand-to-hand combat with a penguin.
Surely the baby penguins could take, you know... You could sort of have age, a bit like weight categories in boxing. You know, you'd do it by age.
Yeah, I mean, there's a brilliant David Attenborough documentary about penguins.
What, about this? About penguins invading Ireland?
No, but I mean, the Brits invaded us, so why wouldn't the penguins? I hope we'd have better luck getting rid of the penguins than we would have getting rid of you lot.
It's a great question, isn't it? Yeah.
You're still here, here after 800 years.
it wasn't the four of us, was it? You can't, Ben's only 26. You can't blame him. Now, lots of people enjoyed yesterday's pod. Thanks for your kind messages. Roshi says, on globalisation, I'm from New Zealand. I've been supporting Chelsea since I was three, been watching nearly every game this season at horrible times. I give examples of what I've skipped to watch the games, but my dad listens to the podcast and he's not allowed to know. Wilson gets it. Stephen says, should Jonathan Wilson be declared a national treasure and be immediately vaccinated? And Stern Lecture Plumbing says, you should all be really proud of the pod you produced today. Top shelf edition. Does that mean something different? I'm not sure that's what me, Wilson, Barney, Baz, I don't know how well we do on the top shelf.
Football anyway. Razzle.
We appreciate the compliment all the same. And that'll do for today's pod. Ben, thank you, mate.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anne-Marie.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jordan.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks, Baz.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.